Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence we have been privileged throughout 2018 to tap with regularity is our next guest. He is David Goldman, better known in some quarters by his nom de guerre, nom de plume, Spengler, under which he writes at the Asia Times. He's also the author of How Civilizations Die, and one of the smartest guys I know on a whole host of topics. We're always pleased to be able to pick his brain. David, welcome back, and the best for this holiday season to you. Glad to have you with us.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you, Frank, and all your listeners. Thanks so much.
So, David, there is considerable thrashing going on at the moment over the president's unexpected, if not completely unforecast, decision to withdraw all of the 2,200 U.S. forces still on the ground in Syria, right quick, as a matter of fact. This has prompted, apparently, General Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, to resign. And I wonder what you make of it.
I don't understand the president's thinking. Unless he has some kind of deal we don't know about with the Russians to collar Iran, which is now colonizing and occupying large parts of Syria, this move will play into Iran's hands. Now, maybe the president knows something I don't. He has more information, so I'm reluctant to criticize it. But there has been a tidal wave of criticism coming from all over the Republican side, and a lot of praise coming from people whom I don't like, for example, Vladimir Putin and the Iranians.
And I think one other who I don't think you like much either, Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey, who I personally think had something to do with this in the call that the president had with him shortly before this announcement, in which it seems Erdogan probably conveyed, as he has elsewhere, a warning that he's about to invade parts of Syria. And what might the effect of that be, as you see it?
If there's a Turkish invasion, there eventually will be some kind of regional conflict between Iran and Turkey. The first person to turn up in Turkey after the president's announcement was, not surprisingly, President Rouhani of Iran, who was greeted with enormous pomp and ceremony, treated like the most honored guest Turkey's ever received. Clearly, there's a short-term deal between Iran and Turkey. But if you have a regional conflict there, eventually it will draw Israel in, and there will be a war on Israel's northern border, and it will be bloody and horrible. And it's just possible that a couple of thousand of American special forces working with our Kurdish allies would provide a buffer to prevent that from happening. So, as I said, I hope the president knows more than I do.
Penny very foolish and pound stupid to precipitate those kinds of responses, if indeed, as I think you're right, they may be in the offing. David Goldman, let me turn to something you've written about recently under the rubric of regime crises. And you point out that there are a number of them at the moment, including, well, one might say here in this country, as a result of the president's relentlessly being attacked by many of his partisan foes, including, one might argue, the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller. Britain under Brexit and so on. I wonder whether China under Xi Jinping at the moment in the face of this so-called tariff war is also in a bit of crisis. Your thoughts?
The emperor in China always is at risk. There have been a couple of attempts to kill Xi Jinping. The position of party leader, yes, the position of party leader is always difficult. At this point, from everything we hear, he's very solidly in control. The economy has slipped a bit in terms of growth rate. We're probably more in the sort of the 5% and the 6.5%, 7% range. But the Chinese are taking urgent measures to stimulate the economy. And I think they'll probably avoid a recession. I think they probably have that under control. Main problem in China is there's no social safety net. So the moment you have any kind of disturbance like threatened trade war, people save instead of buying. So you see a drop in retail sales, prospective drop in economic activity. The Chinese are rushing to spend more money in infrastructure, lower interest rates, and so forth. So I don't expect China to be a locus of that.
But David, do you accept the proposition that we've heard for a long time that if China doesn't have growth rates approaching double digits, that they will have domestic unrest on a scale that could be quite, well, a crisis for the regime?
No, as long as they're 5% growth is fine for them. Remember, their labor force has stopped expanding. They don't have a lot of young people coming into the labor force. So 5% growth will give them full employment, even if something of a labor shortage. So you don't need 10% growth. Maybe 20 years ago, not now.
Let me ask you quickly about one other issue that I gather you've been writing about, including at PJ Media very recently. What China is doing under Xi Jinping to dominate the 5G sector, the telecommunications fifth generation network, and backing very, very aggressively Huawei as the company that is the leader for China in this global race to dominate that next generation technology?
Oh, Huawei now spends as much on R&D as Microsoft, and half its researchers are Europeans. It's no longer a Chinese company. It's the spearhead of China's global ambition to dominate the next generation of technology. They've been screaming to the rooftops what their intention was for the last 7 or 8 years. At every trade fair, on the internet, every interview in the newspapers, it's been obvious. And only at the beginning of this year did one staffer at National Security Council produce a memo saying, wait a minute, we are losing, to quote the memo. We've got to do something about it. What we're doing about it is sadly probably too late in the form that we've approached it, which is to go to the rest of the world and say, please don't use Huawei equipment. But guess what? America doesn't make any internet routers. We are not a contestant in the global battle to control 5G. So we're telling people, go to Finland, go to, you know, Sweden, Ericsson and Nokia. Those are neutral countries, not exactly a great source of American security. And a great danger, from what I can tell, is that most of the Europeans, not to mention the Asians, are not acceding to our request to keep the Chinese out. As a matter of fact, India has invited Huawei in for 5G trials. So that's the largest country in the world by population that appears to be going on the Chinese model. That's a real danger to us economically and strategically.
Yeah, this is what we've been told by, I think I've mentioned this to you before, Declan Ganley, one of the leaders in this technology sector. His concern is that as soon as the end of February, when there is a world wireless conclave, that we may find the Chinese have effectively run the table at that point in both the third world and many of our allied nations as well. David, I'm sorry we are out of time, but this is a topic to which we will certainly return with you in the new year, and I look forward to doing so with regularity. Thank you, my friend. All the best to you for the holidays. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Gertz. We'll drill down on the retirement of General Mattis and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined for our tour inside the ring by the author of a prize-winning column of that name at the Washington Times, Bill Gertz. Bill is also, of course, the senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon, an indispensable online resource in the Washington, D.C. area. He is, among other things, in addition, a best-selling author 7 times over, including most recently his terrific book, iWar, War and Peace in the Information Age. There are few people who understand the wily ways of the building, as it's called, the Pentagon, than Bill. And so who better to talk us through what has just gone down with the president's decision, which we've been talking about a bit with David Goldman, to withdraw all U.S. forces from Syria. And lo and behold, the next thing we know, the Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, has resigned with a bit of a, well, rather thinly veiled critique of President Trump in the resignation letter. Bill, thank you so much for joining us, as always, but especially to walk us through what's going on here. Welcome back.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program. Yeah, it was surprising, but then again, not surprising. I kind of saw the writing on the wall when John Kelly announced that he would be leaving. Mattis and Kelly seemed to have a close collaboration inside the administration, viewing themselves as sort of the adults in the room in trying to keep the administration on an even keel. But he probably disagreed with the decision to pull out the troops from Syria, and that seems to be have been the precipitating event. He's got until February before he actually leaves.
Yeah, the precipitating event, but probably in the nature of the last straw, as far as he was concerned. There were a lot of other things that he did not see eye to eye with the president on, and among them, I presume, as well, the idea of reducing dramatically our footprint in Afghanistan. Bill, your thoughts on these two decisions? What are you hearing from your sources in the Pentagon?
Well, clearly the Syrian decision appears to be a prelude to a similar action in Afghanistan. I know the president has been very active in pushing for getting those troop commitments reduced or eliminated. I mean, he just believes that he wants to use those funds for other means. And the military has very strongly believed that the military presence is needed there, both places. In the case of Syria, it's basically backing the Syrian Democratic Forces. But really, in the Syrian case, it's really a fight over Assad. You know, the opposition forces in Syria want to get rid of Assad. The U.S. has said that's not its mission. Its mission is to get rid of the Islamic State. And so there's always been a little bit of cross purposes there with working with these opposition. Then you have the Kurds, which have been doing very well in the northern part of Iraq, and Syria trying to help that situation. And in the case of Afghanistan, it's one of those if you're not winning, you're losing, and clearly we're not winning there.
Yeah. I'm hoping that what we'll see is a conversion of that program in Afghanistan to something akin to what our friend Eric Prince has been talking about, not abandoning it altogether, as we seem to be doing in Syria, but changing the character of the U.S. presence and the capabilities by bringing in people who are experienced veterans now under contract rather than in, you know, the uniform of the active duty forces of the United States. Bill, there's so much else going on, but just very quickly, you've traveled with Jim Mattis. You've watched him up close during his time in office, both in uniform and, of course, as Secretary of Defense. What do you think the legacy of Jim Mattis will be as President Trump's Secretary of Defense?
Well, he put in a good 2 years in the position. You know, I mean, it's a tough job, and he had a vision for reforming the U.S. military with the idea of making it more lethal and more agile. And he was really kind of a centrist politically. My view is that he understands the military and military affairs absolutely superbly, excellently, and he was learning policy and politics, which is a much different job for military people. You know, he relied on the Joint Staff a lot, and again, he was really trying to learn the politics and policy of being Defense Secretary.
Mm-hmm. Just a little bit of inside baseball there. He was relying, it was reported, on the Joint Staff, some of his military colleagues in his previous life, rather more heavily than on his own civilian personnel, particularly in the policy shop. Is that a fair analysis of the situation?
Definitely, yeah. He's, like I said, he he's a military guy, and he understands how to do that. And I think he was a great addition to the Trump administration. I'll definitely be sorry to see him go, because I feel like if we ever got in a military scrape or dust up with the Chinese or others, that this is the guy you want at the helm of the Pentagon. I haven't heard too much in terms of replacements. I know that some names mentioned have been Tom Cotton, senator from Arkansas. I've also heard the name Jim Talent, again, who I would rather caution. I would not want someone like that in there, but those are the two names that I've heard floated.
Let me throw another name into the mix. He's a member of the House of Representatives. He's also a brigadier general in the United States Army National Guard, I believe. Scott Perry of Pennsylvania is a formidable guy, and he would make a big difference over there, I think, should he be picked. Bill, let me turn quickly to a couple of other things you've been reporting on. Of course, your relentless analysis of what the Chinese are up to is extraordinarily important, and a story that I wanted to give you a chance to talk a little bit about involves this fellow Zhang Zhusheng, who was apparently a very big deal in China's efforts to dominate advanced technologies, including by expropriating them from us. Talk a little bit about him and his untimely demise and what we are to make of it.
He was found dead of a suicide. It turns out that not too earlier than that, early December, he committed suicide. But the latest report by Robert Lighthizer, the U.S. trade representative, identified his company as having played a key role. This was Don Hui, I think is the name of the fund, which was involved in this effort by China called China 2025, which is their effort to corner the market in advanced technologies. And this was a key player. The family insists that he was depressed and that there was nothing untoward related about it. But clearly, it's a mysterious death. And it coming so close to the report raises questions about whether the Chinese may have been behind it.
Well, there are a lot of people who seem to wind up dead when they get crosswise with the Chinese communist regime, as you know, Bill. And you do as good a job as anybody chronicling it. Hey, Bill, very quickly, one other topic that you've written about that I wanted to make sure we covered, because among other things, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, has recently expressed concern about it, and that is Russia's deployment of strategic bombers to Venezuela, well within striking distance from those bases to the United States, especially armed with cruise missiles, as they would be, I assume. Talk us through what the Russians are up to in certainly this very egregious breach of what we used to call the Monroe Doctrine.
The Russians dispatched two Tu-160 Blackjack bombers to Venezuela in a show of force in support of the disastrous Maduro regime in Venezuela. But I'd also want to mention one other story that I had this week that was really important, and that was the Chinese testing of a brand new submarine-launched ballistic missile for the first time. The test took place November 24th, and I broke the story on it in the Free Beacon just this week. It's a very significant strategic nuclear development in the Chinese underwater strategic nuclear delivery capability targeting the United States.
Yeah, and this capability, of course, is just part of what the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, proxies like Hezbollah and Hamas are now doing in Venezuela and other parts of our hemisphere, Bill. And as you look at it, you know, we've spent a lot of time talking about the wall and whether one will be built or won't be built and what the implications are either way. But, you know, you're a big picture strategic guy. Talk a little bit about what it means to the security of the United States if these sorts of countries and non-governmental, you know, terrorist organizations can operate with impunity in our, well, I don't think of it as our backyard. I think of it as our front yard of Latin America.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a major concern. I mean, the Russians are moving closer to the east coast of the U.S. with their vessels and things like that. They're also supporting anti-U.S. regimes around the world. The Chinese are doing the same thing. You know, my solution, we've got to step up our information operations. You know, we have tremendous military power. We have a very important financial and diplomatic power. But on the information front, we're very weak compared to both Russia and China. And we've got to find ways to use information power against those communist and revanchist states like that.
Yeah, amen. Bill, we have to leave it at that for the moment. There's so much more to talk about. We'll look forward to doing that with you in 2019. In the meantime, I appreciate so much your visits with us weekly here during 2018, and I hope it's a very good holiday season for you. Merry Christmas, and we'll talk with you often in 2019. God bless you. Merry Christmas to you. Next up, Matt Brodsky joins us. We'll talk about the Syria business, Afghanistan, and more right after this. This is Frank.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a delight to say Matt Brodsky is back in the house, at least virtually. We catch up with him from time to time about the developments that seem to be happening now with astonishing rapidity in his portfolio. Matt is one of our country's preeminent analysts and commentators on matters in the Middle East, having associations with past and present a number of think tanks in the Washington, D.C. area. He is also a prodigious contributor to the public policy debate through his writings in a whole series of outlets. He's a frequent guest of ours, as I say, and we always welcome him, but particularly at a moment when there's this major upset happening in Washington and elsewhere around the world over President Trump's decision to withdraw post-haste some 2,200 special forces operators on the ground in Syria. And he's going to explain it all to us right now, I'm hoping. Matt, I'm not sure you can, but welcome back. Let's talk about what you think is going on here.
Well, I think when it comes to Syria, we know the president has always wanted to get out of to get our troops out of there. The decision came, which itself is not a surprise since he's publicly been on record saying that. But what it does is it not only pretty much sells out our Kurdish partners to begin with, but it is going to allow Iran to have its established land corridors between 3 to 4 of them, even at this point. It expands the area in which Israel now is to be concerned about how Iran is transferring precision-guided weapons or those type of weapons components to Hezbollah. It also means that ISIS is not only going to be resurgent, because it's just folly to assume that they were defeated. We were fighting them on the very day that the decision to withdraw was announced. So ISIS will remain and reconstitute itself. And another aspect of this is that even if this decision were to somehow miraculously be reversed, the damage we have done to our own credibility to begin with already is nothing short of amazing, and will be really hard to reestablish. We had a really good Syria team in place that was empowered, that the president apparently just did not agree with or believe in. And it took them months to dig out of the, or to get out of the hole that the president created when he said that he was going to pull everyone out of Syria back in March and April. They were finally able to do that, to convince Arab allies not to contribute to the Assad regime's reconstruction, but to keep that money on hold. And a number of other items that we had gotten together with the United Nations to create a pathway forward, constitutional committees, all of that leverage that it was painstaking to reestablish, we have just given away for free, apparently, And I think it's remarkably tragic.
Yeah, it will be, particularly if some of the bad things that are now being forecast to flow from it eventuate. And one of them is the invasion of Turkey. My own personal assessment is that the telegraphing of this punch by Erdogan in a phone call with the president may have been the impetus that prompted him to say, well, I'm going to get our guys out of harm's way by pulling them out. Matt Brodsky, your assessment of what Erdogan is likely to now do with this vacuum of power created. David Goldman earlier in the program mentioned that there's probably a short-term modus vivendi between Turkey and Iran, but that ultimately this is going to translate into a regional conflict, if only because Israel has to take steps to try to prevent the further encroachment in Syria by Iran and its enablers. Talk us through this really important set of issues, if you would, involving Turkey.
I think there can be no doubt that it's based on the phone conversation that President Trump and President Erdogan held, that that's how we came to the decision to remove U.S. troops. But what I find interesting is that while we don't know here what exactly was promised within that conversation, what grand bargain was struck, from Turkey's perspective, they've been quick to say in the wake of that conversation that they won't be respecting Iran's sanctions and a number of other things.
Including that they're going to go after the Kurds, hammer and tong, our so-called allies in that part of the world.
Absolutely, which is, it's unthinkable to then, for any of our allies to assume that the United States will stand with them. I mean, usually at the very top of the list of what one could do to ensure gratitude and, you know, friendship, one would assume that, you know, fighting alongside your troops would be something that would be pretty high on that list.
And the Kurds have been doing a lot of that for a long time, including most recently against ISIS, of course.
Of course, against ISIS, but we could have played this entire situation differently. The Kurds constituted an immense amount of leverage at our disposal that we could have used in any discussion with Turkey, because, of course, there is a long, long list of behavior that's problematic from Turkey that we would like to see changed. It's not like we can just make some grand deal, and because Erdogan said so, therefore we can trust it.
Yeah, my fear, I have to tell you, Matt, is that there wasn't really a deal, that there may have been nothing more than Erdogan simply telling the president of the United States he was poised to invade an area of Syria in which U.S. personnel would be at risk. And he was simply advising the president to get them out of there, lest bad things happen to them. But there wasn't a quid pro quo. We'll see. I guess in the fullness of time, there may be some evidence of it. But that would make this pretty much a complete rout if that were the case. And I hope it's not so. But even if it's not, it looks to the rest of the world, including, as you say, our putative allies, the Kurds, that they've been abandoned, right?
Right. And even if that's the case, and of course, there is the argument that we simply do not have the force structure physically on the ground to prevent such an attack from Turkey, then what we have, and let's be clear about it, and let's have the president come out on television and say a NATO ally threatened to invade and kill American troops. Okay, if that's considered acceptable to the American people, then let the American people decide that. But to me, that seems like a perfectly good reason amongst a long list of others to consider whether Turkey belongs in NATO and whether they in fact are an ally.
Yeah, well, my own conclusion on this, Matt, is that they've long since stopped being an ally and that there is no mechanism for getting them out of Turkey, but there are certainly ways that we can make all of this costly to them, and it should be done within NATO as well as outside. Hey, Matt, let me turn to another topic that I know you're following as well, because it's part of this larger Middle East, and for that matter, part of the larger agenda of our Iranian enemies, Yemen. There has been action taken, as you know, by the United States Senate to cut off all funding for the support that the U.S. military has been providing to the Saudi-led coalition to try to defeat the Iranian-backed Houthi rebels, as they're called, in Yemen. Those rebels have been increasingly aggressive, not only towards Saudi Arabia with missile attacks and so on, but also against shipping lanes passing through the Bab al-Mandeb waterway, the mouth of the Red Sea, a critical passage for oil, much as the Persian Gulf is, and of course the Iranians control the mouth of that as well. Talk us through what's happening here, and what you think are the stakes for the United States of following the line that we're apparently headed on now.
I think what we've seen is those who support Iran, those who are in Turkey's camp, and those who are vehemently anti-Saudi.
And pro-Muslim Brotherhood, too.
And pro-Muslim Brotherhood, sure. I mean, there's a long list of people, of traits of people in those camps. And what they've done, first of all, is a terrific bit of branding, because in the U.S. media, and of course not your show because you've done terrific work on this, but it's now been branded as we're against the war in Yemen. Like, we're just against wars. Okay, let's be clear. What this is an Iranian proxy that's fighting another proxy, and we would like the Iranian side to lose. And as you say, it controls an absolutely vital waterway. I mean, and again, from Israel's perspective, too, as they're looking, somewhat horrifically at developing trends in the region, one of the reasons for starting the 1967 war was the closing of the Straits of Tehran. It had to do with Israeli vital shipping, and that was decades ago.
And that strait, of course, feeds into the Red Sea and is one of the critically important ports for the Israelis to move their products in and out of the country, right?
Absolutely. And this is not to say that our interest there as Americans is Israeli, but it is to say that this is another vital waterway shipping lane. It's the Suez Canal.
And another ally that, if we're not careful, we will also be signaling we're abandoning. And I'm going to be talking shortly with Rick Fisher about what Israel's already up to vis-a-vis the Chinese, which suggests that they're doing a bit of hedging on the reliability of the United States, all of which is very ominous indeed. Matt Brodsky, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but I know that you will be very fully employed in 2019, and I look forward to our visits in the course of that year. I hope it's a happy one. We all survive it, for that matter. But your work is really appreciated, Matt, as are your insights on so many of these topics. Matt, again, thank you for your time today and for joining us throughout 2018. Have a happy new year, my friend, and come back to us often. Next up, we will speak with Rick Fisher right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It is a delight to say we are joined once again by a man I really regard as one of the country's preeminent authorities on Chinese military power and how it is growing inexorably and what the Chinese are likely to try to do with all that power, especially against the backdrop of what we see increasing evidence of day by day, namely their determination to supplant the United States as the dominant power of the world. Rick Fisher is his name. He is a senior fellow on Asian military affairs at the International Assessment and Strategy Center. He's also the president of Pacific Strategies Incorporated. In his most recent book, is China's military modernization building for regional and global reach? It's always important to hear what Rick's updates are, and I'm delighted to be able at the end of 2018 to do a little stock taking and looking forward. to the new year. Rick, Merry Christmas to you and a Happy New Year. Welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, I was speaking a moment ago with David Goldman about this 5G network that the Chinese are building kind of as the digital infrastructure counterpart to their Belt and Road Initiative, much of it engineered and facilitated by a company that I think there's very little doubt is a wholly owned subsidiary for all intents and purposes of the People's Liberation Army. Rick, tell us your thoughts on what's afoot there and the stakes in a military as well as non-military sense.
Okay, well, 5G succeeding the 4G networks that run or are connected to most of our mobile devices, the Wi-Fi that we use and assume is there, like the walls on our house, is being succeeded by 5G. Which is essentially just a much larger straw, if you will, through which more data can pass through at much higher speeds. The Chinese goal here, as is the goal for other competitors to the Chinese companies, is to position themselves to take advantage, to be able to facilitate a future generation of much faster computers and a blizzard of new applications.
Rick Fisher, one of the things that I think we need to talk about as well as 5G and the kind of ambitious program that the Chinese are pursuing for using it as a vehicle for dominating the countries that are going to be putting it in place is, of course, the more traditional signs of Chinese aspirations and desire specifically for the ability to project power around the world. The Navy, as you have been monitoring very closely of the People's Liberation Army, has been receiving, it seems, immense amounts of investment, not just in terms of ships, but also the facilities to build them. Talk a little bit about what you anticipate is coming from the Chinese in that domain.
Certainly, Frank. The Chinese are now engaged in the serial production of aircraft carriers in two shipyards, one in Dalian, one in Shanghai. It's my estimate that by 2049, the 100th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party, that the PLA Navy could have at least 10 aircraft carriers. And perhaps five or six of those could be nuclear-powered. But in addition, the escorts for those nuclear-powered carriers will also be nuclear-powered, nuclear-powered cruisers, nuclear-powered supply ships. And this will enable China to project power globally very rapidly. Now, along with the carriers, China is going to be building up its Gator Navy to support its estimated 100,000 strong Marine Corps that it is building up. Such a Marine Corps would justify the construction of 30 to 40 large amphibious projection ships. Now, this would immediately be a threat to Taiwan if Taiwan has not already been conquered, but it's also a threat to the world. Essentially, China is building a Gator Navy and a Marine Force as large as that of the American Navy and Marine combine.
I have the feeling 40 amphibious ships is actually considerably more than the United States Navy Marine Corps team has in place at the moment, or was likely to in the decades ahead for sure. Rick, and again, you monitor these things better than just about anybody I know. And what, of course, is making this naval buildup all the more ominous is that they are obtaining access to, and in some cases, outright control of ports or manufactured islands or other means of dominating strategic choke points around the world. And as you project forward, it's surely not as long away as 2049, but at some point in the days, if not decades ahead, we're going to see the Chinese combining, are we not, their control of these choke points with the naval power to essentially use them to deny access to those waters or ports or countries, as the case may be, to any they see fit to block.
Indeed, Frank. There are now concerns that Chinese companies could obtain control of ports on all continents today. Just this morning, reports that the Kenyan government's inability to pay debts regarding the modernization of its port in Mombasa may result in Chinese companies taking control of that port near the Horn of Africa.
Yeah, I call this the payday loan scheme that the Chinese are using as part of this Belt and Road Initiative. So they've shaken down the Kenyans, and that is another area of the world that they will be projecting power from. And Rick, you mentioned ports specifically. I did want to ask you about a recent alarming news item that the Chinese are now controlling the port of Haifa in Israel. And this is of such worry to the United States Navy that it is actively contemplating not continuing the naval vessel visits that have long taken place as a sign of the important strategic relationship between our country and Israel. Is this a one-off kind of problem, or is there something even more serious going on vis-a-vis the Israelis and the Chinese?
Well, Frank, it's a long-standing issue, and an issue that we've had with our ally, Israel, for basically 2.5 decades. In the middle of the last decade, we managed to convince our ally that it was not in their interest to sell high military technology to China. And thankfully, Israel has agreed with us on this point. But China's Belt and Road Initiative, the trillions of dollars that it is offering, its ability to purchase and plant allies all over the world, and especially in democracies, where democracies can be more easily manipulated to some degree, is also happening in Israel. And so today, you have indeed the port of Haifa is the major present issue, but there will be future issues in as much as there is some interest in the Israeli government to join the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which, of course, is China's alliance of dictators.
Right. And very much hostile to this country and its friends around the world.
Right. And ultimately hostile to Israel, hostile to all democracies.
For sure. Not least because of what the Chinese and the Russians, for that matter, the other major party in the Shanghai Cooperative Deal, do to arm Israel's enemies. This is a very short-sighted policy, it would seem. But again, Rick Fisher, of a piece with a larger investment, it seems, the Chinese are making in Israel and the Israelis are making in their relationship with the Chinese. This is about as disheartening a thing as I've heard from you in quite some time. And that's saying something, Rick, because your analyses of what the Chinese are up to are always very sobering indeed, not least this business about their buildup of naval power as well as the 5G operations. I know you'll be hard at this work in 2019, Rick, and I hope we'll have a chance to visit with you often in its course, as I can't think of anything more important than keeping our audience apprised on all these topics. So bless you and the work that you are doing. The best to you for the holiday season and the new year, Rick. And the best to all of you as well. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.